Now he distinguished those three realms entirely and talked about their logoi. He first set the realm of divinity entirely apart and set this, the highest logos, which can be called Zeus or God, or cannot be called Zeus or God, it does not matter. The first real neutral philosophical statement in Western thinking, that it does not matter to call the highest principle God or not, as long as the highest principle is there. This he supposed to be entirely separated. That means entirely unknowable. He said that all thinkers before him erred in one thing, that they did not understand that the highest principle, the highest logos, the absolute, is entirely separate. That means it cannot be approached by human thinking, by the human logos. It can only, the human logos can only become aware of it. Heraclitus gives no reasons where the human logos can become aware of an absolute which is otherwise unknowable to human reasoning and human thinking. Those reasons have been later developed by Socrates and by Kant. Heraclitus doesn't give, or we wouldn't have left any reason. He might have given it. We have only very few parts of his work. But he separated this principle of the highest logos entirely. Then he assumed that the world, the universe, the all, or the cosmos, as he would have expressed, is ruled by its own logos, and that this logos is inferior to the logos of man as much as the logos of man is inferior to the logos itself, to the absolute logos, to God. That because it is inferior to the logos of man, the logos of man is able to win insight into the logos of the cosmos. The logos of the cosmos is restricted. This first assurance that man can, by gaining first his self-consciousness, namely the self-consciousness that he is separated from the world by quality, that his logos, the logos that governs him, is superior, or the laws that govern him are superior to the laws that govern nature and the cosmos, and that because of this superiority, the possibility comes in to develop man's mind to a full consciousness of world and nature, of the cosmos. We can say that the whole development of Western science proved this point of view to be very true. We have developed this consciousness immeasurably. We have proven again and again that the logos of man is superior to the logos of nature. But we have forgotten that this is the basic condition, that as soon as we take consciousness out of a development of nature, put ourselves back into nature and declare consciousness, human consciousness, to be only the highest product of nature and the cosmos. As soon as we do that, we put human consciousness back under the logos of nature. That means under the inferior logos. And we lose our ability to handle nature then step by step. Not in the direct way, but in the more awful indirect way, namely by forgetting more and more how to handle ourselves. And so this consciousness becomes the mere logical performance of Hegel and modern philosophy, namely the apparatus, which is nothing but the reflection of the laws inherent in nature, that means of the logos of nature. This reflection then pretends to be the superior thing, but it isn't anymore. One cannot have insight into things that are not inferior, full insight. Ruling things supposes superiority. That is why God, in Heraclitus' concept, can rule men, but men can never even approach God or the highest logos. That is why men can rule nature, but nature can itself not even approach the logos of men, of which Heraclitus said, in order to make the distinction fully clear, you can travel over land and sea and all the world. You will never meet, find the boundaries of the human soul. So deep is its logos. By which he meant that the logos, which he supposed also, that's a mere metaphysical assumption, that it ruled man, or what we later called the nature of man, what we always wanted to find out in order to rule man by his own nature, that in the beginning of Western philosophy, this man declared that this is impossible. Because the logos of man, that what makes men move, is infinite. There is no possibility of calculating it. There is no possibility of predicting it. You will never reach the limits of the human soul, or as we would say here, person. So deep is its logos, which means practically that doesn't have any logos. It is a logos maker. Only if man is an evaluator, which he is, then he himself is not a value and cannot be handled as a value, as we all try to handle each other in our time. Man is invaluable because he is an evaluator. He's a creator of values, and the creator of values is invaluable. He cannot be considered himself to be a value. That would mean to identify him with his works, and would mean to take away the superiority of his logos over the logos of nature, the logos of things, the logos of the worlds. So far, so good. It seemed that the origin, if we take only Heraclitus, who was the most, though he is called the dark one, the most clear one of them all, as to basic and fundamental insights, he seems to have made distinctions which could not be so easily forgotten. Yet they were forgotten very soon. The last one who moved this way was Socrates, who accepted the idea that logos itself, though he didn't call it logos, reason itself, wisdom itself, is entirely separated and cannot be reached by man. That man himself is subject to an infinite logos, so that he never can say, "This I am and will always be." That he always can only say, "This I was, and this was I want to be tomorrow and might be able to become." Socrates argued this way, but Plato already did no more, because then the infinity of the logos that was supposed to rule men like to try to find out about that. That means to rule himself. According to the original position of his superiority, he had only one possibility: to govern himself. Not to rule himself. To govern himself meant to be with himself, every man, in the eternal creative dialogue about truth and more truth from step to step, without ever pretending to have the full truth. Now he wanted insight into the full truth, and that meant for him, according to Heraclitean tradition, insight into the logos of man. He wanted to know what is the nature of man, a definition of man. This logos that moves man, then, could only be a logos derived from the highest logos, which was unapproachable, according to Socrates and Heraclitus, namely the logos of God, or the absolute logos. Approaching the absolute logos in the Platonic way opened the possibility to define man, to find out about the logos of man and make man subject to a logos, instead of, according to him, an infinite logos, as Heraclitus did. It meant to take away his freedom. But it also gave him a wonderful feeling of a new security, that he could find out finally about himself. It needed only the event of Christianity and revealed truths in order to convince mankind, finally Western mankind, that now the logos of man was discovered. The task of man on earth had become clear. He could move only in a very narrow and defined circle, saving his own soul for eternity, for the hereafter. The stiff concept of man in Christian times, by which I only mean up to the end of the Middle Ages, because those only were really Christian times. The stiffness of this concept carried with it a great security and a great arrogance. The arrogance of metaphysicians who thought from Plato on that they were able to find out finally about the logos of man and what ruled man, the laws that ruled man. That means they wanted to find the necessity of man's existence, which ruled out freedom. And the arrogance, of course, of the religious people, which was not that great because it is belief and creed, but also the arrogance to pretend to know what man was here for, to know it once and for all, and close any questioning, further questioning, about this issue, which stopped development. How was it all possible? In the original concept of Heraclitus is a slight error. An error that comes out of the fact that the division from mythical thinking could not be made a clear-cut one. The fact that self-consciousness was first necessary in order to bring consciousness about was done and given in Heraclitus' philosophy, but there was no consciousness about this fact. The fact itself was not analyzed and made clear, and so it could be only too easily forgotten by the ambition of man to overstep the lines that had been set by clear reasoning and thinking. The ambiguity is in the term nomos, which was identified with logos in Heraclitus' thinking. Nomos, law, supposes a lawgiver. If there is a logos nomos to nature, then it means that the necessity with which occurrences in nature move is a designed necessity. That means it is a necessity that has been designed for a certain purpose and for a certain meaning. It is a teleological concept to call that nomos or law. We speak still this erroneous language because every scientist talks about the laws of nature. There is no such thing. There are only rules of nature, which is a very different thing. Everything that does not move by itself, but moves only by being moved in a chain of occurrences, as all natural occurrences do, of those occurrences we can only say that they move and change according to certain rules. The rules can also assume a ruler. There could still be God who is the ruler of those rules, who rules those rules. But if we say they are rules, we would then say that God then did not intend to make them meaningful. They are not designed for a purpose, or at least not for a purpose that is inherent in themselves. The greatness of the event of the Greek polis, the Greek city-state, which made it possible for a thinker like Heraclitus to discover the law, had also the shortcoming that he identified the law with necessity. But necessity and law are different. Rules only are necessity. The law is something else. The law is a set of rules that has intentions, purpose. The rules are only the tools of the law. But the rules are not the tools in nature, in natural necessity. They are the master. To make laws presupposes to be able to break laws. If we want to take the word law in the strict sense, laws are not necessity. Laws are sets of rules that can be improved in order to pursue the purpose of the laws better. And laws are sets of rules that are obligatory only for him who recognizes the meaning of those laws. No such thing exists in nature. But the fact that our scientists still speak about the laws of nature is not only due to their sloppy language, which is not their fault, but the fault of the philosophers of our time, which have for at least 50 years never checked the language of science again and let them go wild. It is much more the fault of the philosophers who have never thought in the last 300 years about their former metaphysical assumptions which they have inoculated into the scientists. And the metaphysical assumption was either that this cosmos has been clearly, as is revealed, according to revealed truth, created by God the Creator, who therefore made every movement in nature as meaningful and purposeful as human doings can be. Or, second metaphysical assumptions that the cosmos is itself God, a supernatural being, so to speak, and on the basis of this development of scientific naturalism is the supernaturalistic assumption that the cosmos is such a being, such a living and purposeful being, and that therefore any of its parts must show and reveal meaning. But we have lost this belief. And we haven't found a single proof for it. The more science proceeds, the more infinite the, in the human sense, empty space of unoccupied planets and this tremendous mass of stars which are merely motion and matter, the more the insight in that, the knowledge of it grows, the less is a belief possible that this has in itself meaning. The relation of all those occurrences to truth is entirely broken. No purpose, no meaning can be seen in them anymore. And with it falls our right to call natural occurrences by the name of laws. We can soberly only say rules. If then we suppose a ruler or not, we do not even know if those rules apply everywhere, as we see in atom physics now. There might be parts, small realms, where rules do not even prevail. But one thing is sure, nowhere we have found any trace of law. By this mixture of law and rule that in Heraclitus' thinking started, it was possible finally to come into the confusion of our age, namely the confusion that natural laws are existent and govern human laws. It is now, if we want to paint the picture, almost the reversal of Heraclitus' original thinking. It is so that the three realms are not separated anymore. They are one in a very funny way. The highest logos is the logos of nature, the all-embracing logos. This logos is superior to the logos of man. And then the third realm, God, or the absolute, has become by the psychological approach. I remind you only of the saying of James: if somebody believes in a God, this God is a reality for him, a mental reality. That means the divine logos, the absolute, is inferior to the logos of man. Man's logos is inferior to the logos of nature, and God's logos, or the absolute logos, is inferior to the logos of man. That is a complete reversal in all points of the original start of our metaphysical thinking in the West. It all has become possible because the dignity of man, about which so much is taught, especially in our age, that has trampled the dignity of man into nothingness. The dignity of man was guaranteed only by two metaphysical assumptions after Plato and after St. Paul. The one assumption was that man can approach the highest logos, namely the Platonic ideas, and live by them and under them. They are at least the right order of ranks is still there. Or the other assumption, that man lives for God. As soon as those two guarantees fell away, the complete reversal became possible, and with it, that what created nihilism, the nihilism of today, the permanent creeping in feeling of nothingness, is exactly due to the fact that this reversal has come about. Because the sense of nothingness is just this metaphysical assumption accepted almost everywhere instinctively, that the logos of nature is the most superior logos, that man's logos is inferior to it, and that God's logos is inferior to man's logos. This is not only taking the thing upside down, it is also destroying the thing in its essence of meaning. If this is so, then every being is completely meaningless. And any search for meaning, any care for more meaning, any search for truth, or any